In this podcast, I'm going to take you in a journey back in time, some 400 million years or thereabouts in time, but the place is going to be the same. It's going to be around Sydney, Australia, moreover the Blue Mountains, which is the mountain range just behind Sydney, cradling Sydney below in its sparkling harbour. And if you look at it from the map, the Sydney is part of a motif of harbours which have almost a Mandelbrot pattern. If you wanted to see a Mandelbrot in nature, you just look at Sydney Harbour, and there's a story behind it. So I'm going to take you in a journey back in time, and in order to do that, we're going to have to go down to the atomic world to do a little bit of geology and basic kitchen science to work out how we're here in this fantastic environment. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. It's part of my cardiac rehabilitation, and I'm trying to actually do a few podcasts a day on topics and just let my brain and stuff like that flush out information and start to order it and make it a bit more coherent to get myself ready for when I get back into the classroom and actually have to start teaching this stuff. As I said, we're going to go through on several journeys, and we're going to go through the journey on several scales: the atomic scale, the particle scale, and then what's happened in history. And I can guarantee you that we're going to stand on top of the tallest mountain that has ever graced our Earth, go through a time of the greatest rainfall, the greatest carbon dioxide, the greatest forests, and the world's biggest river, as all part of the geology which makes Sydney. You wouldn't know it at the moment. It's just a plain, a mountain, and a vista, and traffic and bustle at the moment. So this is Sydney, Australia. So if you go onto your maps and look in the southern hemisphere, this island sitting beneath Asia, out of the way, hopefully out of the way of all wars and stuff like that. We've never had a foreign, besides the original British coming in, we've never had a foreign country actually step foot on our shores, just because we're so far away and it's not immediately a lot of infrastructure to walk in and own. Things are changing though. But let's get back to it. And as I've guaranteed, we're going to go on the atomic scale, the particle scale, and move beyond. And part of this, hopefully listening to it, if you're a science buff, you'll start to pick up some side science, sort of listen into it. And so the first thing is I want you to open up your periodic table and locate oxygen in our sixth group six. There, oxygen, and beneath, next to it goes carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine. So you go to carbon, go beneath it to silicon. That's in the fourth group, silicon, and the Blue Mountains is sitting on top of, it's like a layered cake. It's got some volcanic minerals. I don't know what's beneath that. It's got a big layer of coal, other sandstone, another huge layer of coal. This is a huge, when I talk about a huge layer of coal, this is more coal than people can possibly imagine in the Earth. It stretches from a city 100 kilometres to our north and in a basin underneath to another city in the south of us. Wollongong, we have this huge coal basin, hundreds of kilometres, but underneath a kilometre of sandstone, of course. Oh, and I should say above this is a kilometre of sandstone. River rock, in actual fact. So we've got a riverbed. This whole area, hundreds of kilometres across, is a riverbed, a river, hundreds of kilometres wide, and has been flowing for millions of years. Not hundreds of millions of years, just millions of years, and has deposited a kilometre thick of a river sandstone. And that's where we're at, and we have to go from our periodic table to sand. And I don't like using the word sand because scientifically sand refers to a different thing besides the chemical sand. But the chemical sand that we do know of is silicon dioxide. That's silicon and two oxygens. Now, I'm going to pull you back and hope that you remember that carbon can form a diamond crystal, a tetrahedral crystal. So the diamond is a tetrahedron, a little three-sided pyramid, and it can actually form a stack of three-sided pyramids. So each has got, to carbon, it's got four bonds, and each bond goes to another carbon, and it forms this super hard lattice. And that carbon lattice is called none other than diamond. It's actually like a silicon, it's a diamond is a semiconductor with a large band gap. So that's structure. Now, silicon dioxide, silicon, pure silicon, also forms a diamond structure. That's pure silicon. This is a slab. It doesn't occur in nature, pure silicon, because it's too much for it to bond with, but we can actually make pure silicon. And if I had pure silicon, that's a lump of matter made only out of silicon atoms, I could form it, in a structure of a tetrahedral structure. So each silicon has four bonds. Three bonds form a little sort of three prongs downwards, an upwards prong, which supports another silicon atom above, which links into it and forms a tetrahedral structure. Again, you'll have to possibly go on the internet or remember your story about tetrahedral structure. Now, oxygen in silicon dioxide forms something which is not that dissimilar. It's a tetrahedral structure, and for each bond, you remove the bond length, the sharing electron, and put in an oxygen. An oxygen, one oxygen forms a bond with one silicon and turns around and forms a bond with the other. So oxygen, by having two bonds above and below, can actually stick into this bond and form again a new tetrahedral structure, but the link which used to be between the two silicons has now got an oxygen in it. So you can imagine the silicons sitting in a tetrahedral array in space, three-dimensional space, and between each of these silicons is an oxygen, and that forms silicon dioxide. And it's not a straight line. In actual fact, there's a bit of tension here. Although it would be ideal if it was a straight bond, but it's got a slight angle. I'm just trying to, in the back of my head, I've got 104 degrees above. You know, that's just, I don't know whether the answer is correct. That's just a number floating in the back of my head. But the interesting thing is that silicon dioxide is basically a chemical form. It's a chemical form of silicon or diamond. But it's got oxygen in it. And if you count, there's two oxygens for every silicon, because there's one oxygen on every bond. And the way that you count it up and share it, you can see that there's two for every silicon. So you get silicon Si, capital S-I-O, and a small 2, to say there's two oxygens. And this is forming a crystal. There's a crystal, a small crystal. If you built it on the bench, it would have definite edges. And as you grow it up, it definitely has edges. And this forms a clear crystal called quartz. So this can grow larger and larger to form quartz. Now, just a little bit of an aside, just to get you thinking. Large quartz, these beautiful large quartz crystals. And now, the shape of that quartz crystal is, it forms a hexagonal tube. It's got six sides, and it comes up to a point. And I suppose one of the major things that quartz does, with light going through it, it rotates the polarization. A crystal of quartz rotates the polarization going through it. So if I've got linearly polarized light and I fire it down the axis of the quartz, it will oscillate and be held back. And as it oscillates, it slowly twists and turns. It's a very interesting property of quartz. But that's just an aside, another beautiful thing that you can do with quartz is that you can get gaseous silicon, I think silicon dichloride and silicon silane, which is SiH4. These are gases, and you can burn them in oxygen, and this can form a silicon dioxide smoke. These are really small particles. They're not individual, but there's, let's say, hundreds or thousands of silicon dioxide atoms in form of these little crystals, and that's called a fume. Silicon dioxide smoke. The smoke will settle down and forms a beautiful paste there. So silicon dioxide's diamond, it's really water insoluble. It's taken up in plants as a defense to make them a bit harder, a bit more abrasive. And so essentially herbivores which eat the silicon dioxide, which gets as a molecule in the system and built as a support, will actually eat, and this will tend to wear down the teeth, sort of like an abrasive of plants. So that's silicon sand and sandpaper. And so that's really, we've got a kilometre thickness of silicon dioxide. I'm not going to call it sand. And I think this is important. The other thing is that silicon dioxide is much lighter than the equivalent, or less dense than the equivalent material of liquid metal. So when you make a glass, so it basically, if you keep on, you can dissolve more and more metal into your glass, namely lead, I think they discovered early on, but other metals, sodium, not so much magnesium, other metals in, and this will break up the crystal structure. So the crystal structure will have no order in it. If you add enough metal into it, it'll have no order, and this will form a glass. I'm mentioning this because silicon dioxide is in glass, and it's important because there is glass in the Blue Mountains. It's a very important thing to understand. But I'm going to say that the beautiful glass that you have around nowadays is something called float glass. That is, you put the silicon dioxide, which is still doesn't actually have a melting temperature, has a softening temperature. There is a phase transition. It's a viscous liquid. You pour it on top of liquid metal, and it will form a very, very flat interface, and that's called float glass. It's only invented, since last century. And this is one of the things which always grabs me as a science buff. I'm looking at period pieces, people dressed up in the finery, horses, porcelain, bonnets, and all this stuff writing to Mr. Darcy. And they walk up to their window to look out, sort of soulfully in this period time, and I look through. And they look through float glass, and I go, oh, blooper. It's sort of like seeing a TV set or a wristwatch in Ben-Hur. For me, for period drama, I really want them to have pre-float glass, as they used to have in the window panes. And indeed, in Australia, you can see some in some of the older institutions, the very old institutions, still with the wood heavy frames on the outside. This non-float glass, you can actually see bubbles in it, and it's got a bit of a wave to it, and that's very much there. When I talk about float glass, we as a continent are floating on a metal sphere of the Earth, and so the continent is floating up, and that really finishes the atomic physics aspect of what I'm talking about in terms of silicon dioxide forming little crystals, and this is being light and floating up. So this is why there's so much sand in a continent, because the continent is above water and it's floating. And you've got all those aspects of it, and it's you've got silicon dioxide is something very hard and breaks up. But this is an important thing: is that silicon can break up. You can heat it up, goes through a crystal phase around 600 degrees, and chemically it can actually break up and fracture. You can fracture a quartz crystal if you heat it up and cool it down too quickly. So there's some weathering elements can actually break it up into little bits of sand. So that's covered the physical atomic properties that I'm going to. And now I'm going to talk about there's a very small dust properties. And of course we're talking about weathering and this being all stuck together. And if I tell you how it's all stuck together, I can't really go back. I have to give you the information for you to actually build what's going ahead. One of the important things is to understand that the term nanoparticle and clay, that's pretty much the same thing. A very small particle is called clay. A slightly larger crystal I can actually feel in my hand, that's called sand. So clay I can't feel it, it sort of rubs and gets moisture. Sand, a piece of grit you can feel, that's sand. It goes up through a whole series of categories, a word for a size. And so you get, I think there's gravels, there's pebbles, there's cobbles, there's boulders. I think there might even be stones or something like that. There are all these terms. I haven't really looked at it. But that refers to the particle size. And the particle size is all that important. And so sand that we understand is silicon dioxide. But the important thing is the particle size. Now, sand itself, and this is a bit of a stop press, is see-through. So if you get some sand and you magnify it in a microscope. Can I recommend a USB microscope? No, it's very easy. This is one of these USB cameras hooked up to a zoom lens and you just plug it into your computer and expand. If you look at sand, it's actually see-through. It's translucent. And it's actually these beautiful things of quartz. Now, if you look up, you can see that the surface is very much scratched. And sand is white because it is scratched see-through material. The whiteness of sand comes from scratchiness, the scratchiness of it. And from that scratchiness, you can actually look at it and see how the sand was made. So if it's been weathered off some hard, just freshly weathered, it's got these hard edges. And when it's got these hard edges, it will feel gritty, it will sound differently, and it'll be ideal for building sand castles because you build it up, and when the water drains away, it dries. The sand has got these edges and they lock together. Of course, if it's a beautiful, soft river sand, when you look at it under the microscope, it's really soft, round edges. So you can pick up some sand or some sandstone and work out a whole heap of things, i.e., the depth of the river, the speed of the river, all these sorts of things, you can look at it. And just a note for a very dangerous thing that you could do, I'm just watching opposite, there's a little school here which I can watch. You've got a long jump pit. So you have a sand pit for toddlers, and in general, people like the really soft, smooth sand, but they can't actually build anything, toddlers. If you give them really smooth sand, it gets everywhere. Sort of the hardest bricky sand, we call it, for putting it up, or the sandcastle sand. You don't want that sand in your long jump pit. You want the beautiful, smooth, river, round sand. So when you hit, the sand moves and dissipates the shock wave in it. And if you look at the sand from the long jump pits, they're all round. You can see how recently the sand's been abraded, because if it's just been recently dry and abraded, it will be covered with these nanoparticles, little bits of sand. And unfortunately, I'm going to tell you that those little bits technically could be called clay. And of course, from around Australia, there's dust blowing in. So this clay is really basically wet dust. This dust blows in, and this is important because the sand is deposited, in this case, by a river. I'm going to tell you how the river got there. The sand is deposited by a river, and it also deposits dust and grit, which we will call frit. And this frit has got, the sand is very pure, but the frit's got a lot of dirt and metal in it, a whole lot of tiny little glass particles, and the smaller something is, the greater the surface area it is. and greater chemical reactivity is. And so what happens if you have sand and dirt, if you have a sufficient metal, yes, you heat it up, it will actually completely melt and turn to glass. But if you heat it up, the sand will not melt, the tiny little bits of sand will melt and form a cement glass. So here we go from trying to describe what sand is molecularly to sand and sandstone. So if I get some sand and heat it up a little bit, I can actually get the actual, with a bit of pressure, heat and pressure, I can actually turn the dirt and sand dust on the outside to a glass. And so if you can imagine, you can make a glass make a sandstone by forming sand and creating a cement structure. Now, at school, when I explain this, I have sugar and sand, and I get the kids to actually make their own sandstone. And they make some sandstone, and they look at their sandstone, and they look at the actual sandstone they make, and it's really hard to tell the difference. I've had some people say, oh, can I eat it? And start to eat the sandstone, and saying, oh, it's really crunchy, oh, I don't like it. And of course, what can you do? So the important thing is that sandstone has a grit, and the strength of sandstone really is not to do with the size of the crystals, it's to do with the chemicals and the grit. And this has got a large importance into the story of the Blue Mountains. So we've just finished chapter 1 and 2. Chapter 1 was the molecules, silicon dioxide. Chapter 2 was the bigger particles together. And now we have the story going back, I think, roughly off the top of my head, 400 million years ago, because I know at this stage that we have to have ideal conditions for trees to grow on land, because at this stage where we've got a continent in Antarctica and this is on the southern part, it's a much hotter climate, there's a lot more carbon dioxide, so there's a lot more global warming, and in around Antarctica is a huge flat sea. Now, a flat sea means one thing, and the one thing that does mean is that the water heats up, the water rushes into this flat sea, heats up and evaporates. It's like a huge continent-wide evaporation dish. And what this does is increase the rainfall to the whole planet, but basically mostly in Antarctica. And particularly if you've got a mountain growing, the mountain hasn't grown yet, it's flat. And what happens is that this high carbon dioxide, warmth, rain, these conditions, and obviously no animals or insects to eat trees all that much, you have tree growing gone bananas. And this is called the Carboniferous era. Carbon dioxide is sucked out of the atmosphere and trees grow. And they grow so fast that they grow, the logs fall and the next tree grows on top of the next log. And this creates fossilized logs which get pushed down. And this is our first coal layer. So that's our first thing. This is still Antarctica. There's a small mountain range and this grows and pushes a river on top of this and puts some sandstone, and then another event occurs again and we have another coal layer. This is going around all around the planet. We have these large carbon forests making our coal deposits. And then we're in Antarctica and another thing happens is that the conditions which actually push Antarctica together do several things. It creates a rain shadow, creates an arid conditions which lead to conditions where there's insufficient water and our amphibians no longer can lay their eggs in water. They actually have internal fertilization. So that's one aspect. But this mountain building grows and grows and grows. And eventually Lithgow, which is a village further away from Sydney, on the other side of the Blue Mountain, increases in height. So you've got mountain building, and increases in height to a mountain higher than Mount Everest. So we now have a mountain range bigger than the Himalayas, more precipitous than the Himalayas, and it's not sedimentary rocks, it's pure silicon dioxide going up in this huge mountain range. And we also have this flat sea, a huge rainfall. So this is 10 times, 10 or more times the rainfall that we know at the moment. And this creates a huge river, 10 times larger. We know this because we can measure the river stone flowing from Lithgow to way out to the continental shelf, hundreds of kilometres out from Sydney, beneath our current sea level, this huge water flowing out at this huge river. We know it's a gentle river because we can actually see, we can dig down and see the sandstone there. Okay, that's the size of this rock. This was actually formed by gentle flowing water. We can actually see the flow rate and the size, the angle, the steepness. We can work this out. And this happened again in our first period of sandstone, first 500 metres of sandstone. This is going, and there's when this is going, this huge river is growing. It was very pure sandstone. So the first, if you're going down a kilometre, that from the coal layer up, the first 500 metres is this very pure sandstone, and you can grab it in your hands today and just crush it in your hands. It's a very soft sandstone. This is going to be important. And then conditions change. There's more dust blowing in, and the new layer, the next 500 metres of sandstone build up. It's this river flows down to the sea, mightier than the Amazon River, but shorter, and a huge rainfall. So if you can imagine every 23 hours a day torrential rain forming on the side of this mountain, this sort of stuck weather system blowing down. And we know this because we know the size of the river, the speed, and all the stuff we can go up. And again, look, in the Blue Mountains, you can actually walk along a cliff face and see what are dragon's teeth. These are fairly large lumps of silicon, of quartz, just stuck in there where the river has changed a little bit and it's deposited these quartz little pebbles. It's fine sandstone. So you can read this in the rocks here. But going up, the last layer, I think it's Hawkesbury River sandstone, a slightly different sandstone. And this sandstone has more dust in it, and it's a stronger sandstone. Cement is stronger. Sand is the same, but the cement is stronger. Indeed, amongst this are other crystals held in there which tell us the exact time. We can actually pick up the time, a clock from this was first buried. We can actually tell the ages. So there's heaps and heaps of information that we can gather out. So as they have hundreds of geological markers and clues and messages, we're getting the overall story. There is one mystery, of course, because this is all happening 360 million years ago, around that time. The mystery is that the beach sand, the sand on the beaches at Bondi Beach and beyond, is not that river sand. It's another sand which is far more ancient. For some reason, the beaches of Australia have a sand which is far more ancient than the actual sand inland. So at the moment, we've got this mighty river, this mighty mountain, and this mighty mountain has built this river, and this river is a whole lot of water and a whole lot of sand, and it's pressing down, and the mountain and Australia has sprung close, and it's rifting and pushing away from Antarctica and beginning its journey north. And as it goes in, this sinks beneath the sea, and so there's actually a sea level above us. Now, there's some other interesting points along here is that I haven't told you. I have to go back. As you add more and more metal to silicon dioxide, you say, well, yes, I get get a glass. But what in actual fact happens is you've got a whole lot of magnesium, and if you add a sufficient metal to sand, you get something called shale. And what happens is that it really can't cope with the metal, and the metal forms these crystals on the top and bottom of the sand and forms these shearing shale. So basically sandstone, which has had more metal in it, turns into shale, which is this shearing stuff. And we also have shales up here further inland. We've got the shale building up as more metal has come in. So we've got those sorts of things. I thought I'd tell you about that, about sandstone and shale. There's a sort of a continuum between sandstone and shale. And the actual shale becomes crystalline because of the metal. It's formed these large, flaky crystals. And you can, and slate is another example. Slate, you know, has got these cleavage planes where you can cut off. But we're here is that sandstone's gone in, and this will be underneath the oceans. If it hadn't been for Australia having the amazing thing that has been pushed over a hot spot, and this heat has actually blistered the rock underneath and forced it up again. And so we have a mountain chain running from the north of Queensland all the way down to Victoria, and this is providing heat and blistering rock and pushing it up. And so the Blue Mountains have been pushed up and blistered up, and we do have volcanoes. So you can stand on the edge of the Blue Mountains and look out on the river plain out to Sydney, and you can see these little volcanic mountains, and you can look at the back of the Blue Mountains and see volcanic cones, and this has got a highly fertile rock. And this is another aspect of the Blue Mountains, because it's a riverbed and there's no organic material inside it, and it's so purely built, it's very infertile soil. So Blue Mountains water, there's a fair amount of water compared to the rest of Australia being dumped on the Blue Mountains, but particularly in the area of the Blue Mountains where I'm at, there's not a lot of fertility. Because there's not a lot of fertility, there's not a lot of megafauna. So in the area, north and south, there's kangaroos and koalas, but native to the Blue Mountains, you've got very little major megafauna. I thought I'd say that. You do have wallabies at night and things like that, and vagrant animals like dingoes coming in. And so what's happened is that as Australia's moved forward, you can imagine this mountain building process, first starting off in Queensland. And in Queensland, there's actually calderas, which is cauldrons. This is where there's been a large lump of molten material coming up, and that lump has then drained and formed a valley where that lava reservoir has disappeared. And you have lava tubes up in Queensland. So the most ancient volcanoes are up in Queensland, so there's a lot of fertile soil up there. And we have fertile patches where the volcanism's gone up, and that's definitely the botanical gardens in the Blue Mountains and around Sydney are on these volcanic hot spots of fertile growth. And this has gone up and pushed up the Blue Mountains. And this hasn't given you the last secret of the Blue Mountains. Although everything is bigger and better in the United States, we have support the second biggest canyon system in the world. And we have this beautiful canyon-forming structure of geology. We have the hard canyon walls of this hard cemented sandstone at the top, and then underneath we have this very soft sandstone which washes away really quickly. So we have this easy to erode undergrowth and these cliffs going along, so you can walk along and see these canyons. It's a huge, more very complex canyon system. The American canyon system is more or less in one direction. This is in all directions, and there are certain things like fault lines. So when the fault line grows, the water follows this long, straight fault line. So you have these fault lines here. One is for a huge dam. Sydney's huge dam is along a fault line. And so this is, you see all this complicated fractal pattern as the sandstone erodes. Just to the south of me is a region. It's not all that spectacular, but it's called the Blue Labyrinth because the valleys are so complicated and it's very easy. I can attest to the fact that you can get lost and you can find these hidden waterfalls, and it's a really fantastic place to look. So you have the erosion and you have these valley floors with these gentle alluvial fans of the soft sandstone and these cliff features. And these are spectacular cliff features. The tourists go in the sort of the shortest distance, but if you actually go through and look back, it is it's 360 degrees of pure canyon. It's a fascinating thing to see. So just in front of us is this is between the Blue Mountains and Sydney. It's the Nepean River. It's a long, straight river because it's following a crack. And actually, the river actually goes in back into the Blue Mountains again. And so you don't go very far. And there's these cliffs either side of this river where the river could easily, by rights, have gone straight in towards Sydney. And now what's happened is that this process of mountain building has occurred in several phases. And so you had the main mountain build, the river has formed, and then there's been a secondary catch-up mountain build, which is my place around Glenbrook, these beautiful things up. So you can go up and actually read the history as you walk down these cliffs. You can actually see the rock sides. You can actually see the river flow, where the river's flowing fast. The actual strata will start to point at a slightly different direction because it's not been laid flat. It's been laid at an angle. You can see the different silts. There's some rocks here you can just put your hand in and crush because it's not sand. It's still silty. And further down at the base of the Blue Mountains, you can actually walk around and pick up coal. And originally, there were all these coal mines at the base of the Blue Mountains where these poor people came and mined. Of course, there's unfortunately for the world, heaps of coal to burn. So I hope that's given you a journey and an interest. And out there, please go on the internet, go to Google Earth or Google Maps and have a look around at the Blue Mountains. But there is this beautiful story which can link it all together, starting off with the atoms, the atomic structure, giving you the quartz crystals, some physics about the size of those quartz crystals and the dust which forms the cement, and a story there how you get different strengths of sandstone coming together, and the story of Australia when it was nestled in Antarctica receiving a real lashing, a fantastic forests which have formed these huge coal deposits, huge rain events from the shallow sea, and a huge mountain range, much taller I'm told, possibly a kilometre more taller than Mount Everest, a huge range and a huge river system. And although you wouldn't see it today, when you pick up a rock from the Blue Mountains around here, and people say, look, everything's sandstone. It is indeed sandstone. You can tell the story and actually feel the history of the place. So I'm sure there are other places around the place, but this is a truly ancient, fascinating story where it's really one story. Not a lot of has happened. It's been one story, and it's a unified story, which I can tell in this podcast. So I hope my podcasting is improving. The general aim is to practice enough of it such that I don't get a chance to plan, I think, and the information just pours out and structures as it comes through. So I hope I'm beginning to achieve that a little bit more. So in the meantime, thanks for listening, and in the meantime, keep on doing science.